Hello and welcome to A Pint of Cthulhu with myself, Matt, and my co-host Jay, and today we are interviewing Chris Pickett about his amazing game, Dance Macabre. Chris, would you like to introduce yourself?
That's too kind, but I appreciate it. My name is Chris Pickett. I am a multidisciplinary artist living in Brooklyn, New York. Originally from Texas, but somehow made my way up here, and now I'm freezing my ass off. I should have asked, is cursing okay?
Oh, hell yeah.
All right, great. Yeah. Sweet. Yeah, fuck it. let me do it again. I'm a multidisciplinary artist living in Brooklyn, New York. I'm the author and illustrator for Dance Macabre, which currently mostly exists as a kind of quick start, which we're calling Prima Mors, which means first death in Latin. We're playtesting, we're building it out and all that good stuff, but I'm sure we'll get to that.
Nice. So for the question we ask first every time, if a pint of Cthulhu was a drink, what would it be?
Oh my god. If Pint of Cthulhu was a drink, I'm imagining something like, what's that drink that people make? It's like the Hulk or something like that. It's very green. It's like a blue liquor and I don't drink anymore, so. I got it. It's a Michelada, except that, do you know what a Michelada is? Are y'all familiar with that in the UK? It's a Mexican drink that is usually like clam juice, tomato juice, and then beer, essentially. But one of the fun things about micheladas is that there's a lot of like skewers that you can kind of put into it. A lot of skewers you can put into it. Like people put tamarind and all that kind of good stuff. But I'm imagining if you've ever watched Star Trek Lower Decks, there's an episode where they have micheladas that have these little Federation skewers on them that have like weird alien bits. So that's kind of what I'm imagining, is like maybe a Michelada with like some calamari. You got to get your tentacles in there, and maybe some kind of like non-carcinogenic food dye to make it especially bright and scary looking.
Very good answer.
Just found the Hulk you're on about. Fruit liqueur.
Hypnotic, yes. Oh, yeah. That's a very, very American drink.
I've never even seen that written down.
Hennessy, why?
Hennessy brand, served.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
Hypnotic looks good, though. I'd drink that.
Hypnotic is blue, sweet, fruity, which... Huh.
Good, basically, I think.
I might have to make that.
Yeah, actually. Add it to the list. Again, when we get together in June, we're drinking all the Pint of Cthulhu cocktails. I don't care how bad they are.
Not all of them.
People have said seawater and salmon-flavored whiskey before. We're doing it.
There you go. I'll send you the link to that one. You can have that one.
You know, honestly, I could get behind that. Salmon-flavored whiskey sounds kind of disgusting, but maybe in an intriguing way.
Yeah. It's questionable.
Gotta ask, what is the temperature over there at the moment?
Oh, it is currently 19 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but that's all I can give you. It's cold. It's below freezing.
Minus seven
Celsius. Yes. Yeah. It's pretty nippy. It's funny. We've had such a strange winter. I'm sure that this is globally, what with temperatures rising, 2024 being the hottest year on record. But we've had such a weird winter where it's not been seasonal. It's been strangely warm and clear. And then this past weekend, we had a total whiteout, and now everything is covered in snow and it's freezing cold. So.
Yeah. By the way, just for us, Matt, was it Styles that said it was minus 10 Fahrenheit where he was?
Yeah, I think he had
that's minus 23 Celsius.
Yeah, was that? Boy, I'm going to guess that's somewhere. Is that somewhere in the Midwest, in the United States, or? Yep, that makes sense. Yep.
So getting back onto the questions at hand, rather than the weather.
This is your Pint of Cthulhu weather report. A couple weeks late, probably.
More than likely. What inspired you to start creating your own TTRPG?
Oh, man. Honestly, just a lifetime of nerdery, I think, is the is the only answer that I have. I've been playing tabletop role game or tabletop role playing games since I was about 12 or 13, I think. I think right around my 13th birthday is when I picked up Dungeons and Dragons 3rd Edition, and I just immediately was completely enamored with the concept, with the items, with the possibilities of it all. And you know, I've played off and on for a little over 25 years now, and I think, like a lot of people who find themselves in the kind of, and I don't say this derogatorily, I think it's a good thing. I think that we need these people, myself included, not to pat myself on the back, but you know, people that are in forever GM positions, you have a tendency to kind of slide or bleed into game design anyway. You know, you start adapting rules, you start doing house rules. Again, rule of cool should always take precedence. And yeah, I mean, you know, eventually it turned into creating my own settings for things. In particular, I've never been a fan of, this might be controversial, I don't know, I'm not a fan of magic in TTRPGs, like magic systems. I think, especially in our kind of, you know, canon of Western fantasy role-playing, it just has never really made sense to me. Like, how could you have people with ultimate power over the elements in reality and they're not complete fascists? That's always my question. So the worlds of, you know, Faerun, all the D&D settings, never really clicked for me in that way. So I started adapting 5th edition probably around 2015, 2016, right after that first came out, into just a low to no magic setting. And that was kind of the start of my, I guess, journey into writing my own game. And there's kind of direct ties, or there's a direct throughway between that into Dance Macabre.
Nice. It's always interesting when people do things vastly different from the popular ones, because like D&D's a big one, so you find a lot of stuff that's very similar to it in smaller ones. It's nice to see people branching out. Did you have any particular inspirations when you were creating your game?
For Dance Macabre, yeah, I mean, I'm a big history nerd. The game itself is set in the late 14th century, so it's I think canonically we've said 1390 is kind of the start point for when you start playing the game. And it's set in Constantinople. So really, some of the biggest influences on the game have been... first, a history text by a scholar named Barbara Tuchman. She has a book called A Distant Mirror, which is just about the 14th century. And she mostly focuses on France and a little bit into the Mediterranean. But something that I really, really love in that book is that she drives home that at that time, you know, people died in mass to the pestilence, to the Great Plague, Black Plague, whatever we want to call it now. But then after that, things started to change into, or things started to look a lot like our kind of modern ideas of humanitarianism and individualism, and also the kind of beginnings of nascent mercantile capitalism were at that time. So for me, you know, I wanted to kind of explore that time period from a weird perspective, but also try to embody those changes in the characters that people are playing. So yeah, in Dance Macabre, just to summarize for folks that don't know, if you die, you are generally resurrected within a few hours. And when you come back with these mutations that we're calling Maleficia. And, you know, those are mostly bodily mutations. Some of them are kind of like, you know, I guess what we'd consider like mental powers, or there's some pyrokinesis, there's some things like that that touch on being magic, but trying to ground it in kind of not biological realism, but something akin to it. So really, for me, those mutations and those maleficia become a lever by which we can kind of explore these social changes. But also just ask the question of like, well, what if we just put a stop to the beginning of Capital? What if we just changed history from that point forward? What would that look like?
Was there anything that, because I love that you've done this, a lot of fantasy TTRPG stuff focuses kind of on later European medieval kind of stuff, you know. And was there a reason why you chose Constantinople? Because that's a little bit further across the map than a lot of TTRPGs focus on.
Yeah, I mean, one reason is just because it's interesting.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's super, super interesting at the time. You don't hear about it much in kind of, again, the Western fantasy canon. And, you know, I think... Well, actually, let me back up. The game originally, the first version of the game, which was very, very different, was set in medieval France. And I kind of kept on running into things where it's just like, it didn't feel satisfying. It felt too, I don't want to say homogenous, but just, I don't know, it felt like every other OSR game that I've seen in a lot of ways. So my good friend, co-host on our podcast, and editor, publisher, Wythe Marshall, and I got to talking about it, and I had started looking into Constantinople around that time, just out of, you know, curiosity more than anything, and we kind of settled on that as the ideal setting for it, because it's this amazing crossroads between, you know, Asia Minor and Europe, across the Bosphorus Strait. You have the possibility for a lot of different cultures to come through, whether it's trading or through, you know, other means, after the events of Danse Macabre take place. And I think one of the coolest things about Constantinople is that time is it's the complete twilight of the Byzantine Empire,
yeah,
or what we would consider the Byzantine Empire, right? By 1490, they were basically just Constantinople. They had lost all of their territory to Serbs and Turks and everybody that was coming through at the time. And
even by like mid-1300s, when your game is...
Oh, yeah.
It's just like Macedonian a little bit extra.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the cool things that I found out through doing research is that by that time in real world history, about half of the city of Constantinople was just abandoned. Most of the people that still lived there had kind of congregated around the eastern part of the city, which is like where the harbors and kind of the original city center was. But then you have this massive expanse of land that's just been completely abandoned, because it's too expensive or there's not enough labor power to take care of it. And it just kind of went to, what's the term I'm looking for? To seed? I don't know. It just, yeah, it went to ruin, basically. So it presented us with an interesting opportunity where it's like, all right, we have a millenarian or apocalyptic kind of event that we're dealing with. We have a bunch of different cultures in close proximity, and we've established that kind of city states are the main governing bodies at this time in the game. So the idea came to us to basically treat Constantinople the way that we would look at like Cold War Berlin in a way, where it's one city, but it's been split between two different populations, two different ideologies. In this case, you know, the kind of Greco-Romans that are left from the Byzantine Empire, as well as Turks and other folks that are coming in who, you know, previous to the events of the game were Islamic, largely still are. And yeah, just kind of having that mix and that soft conflict, I think, between the two presents a lot of interesting narrative opportunities that we were, you know, just wanting to really dive into.
Sounds really fun.
So, can you then tell us about the core mechanics of your game and how they generally differ from other RPGs that you have played?
Sure, yeah. So the game runs off of the Grit system, which is kind of, for Stillfleet Studio, it's our kind of in-house mechanics system that was thought up by Wythe.
Is this the thing... system that is also that also has Blitzkrieg running on it?
Yes, it is. So Stillfleet, Blister Critters, and Danse Macabre all run on the Grit system. I've altered it a little bit to fit with the setting more, in my opinion. But the basic idea for Danse Macabre is that you have four attributes or scores, which are vitality, finesse, insight, and fervor. So each one of those scores is assigned a die type whenever you're creating your character. And when you are making checks, like in a lot of other games, You're rolling that die type, trying to beat, match or beat a six in order to succeed. So, you know, if you have a D4, kind of hard to do in one type. Obviously, you know, the higher the die type, the better the score. In the grit system, there's also a mechanic called grit, unsurprisingly, which is a resource. I mean, y'all know this, but I'm saying it for the
podcast.
Yeah. It's a resource that you can burn, that you can spend in order to either use or activate powers that you have or to boost die rolls. So it's a really interesting kind of economy that that lives in there that I think creates a lot of really cool tension.
Nice.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, we love D20 games, but also I think the grit system really excels at feeling or looking crunchy without feeling overly crunchy. It's incredibly easy to teach. You know, at conventions and stuff, it's 5 minutes and people get it almost immediately. I also think it's more fun because you're just not doing as much math. You know the target numbers that you're trying to hit. You're just trying to get it. So, yeah, I think, you know, nice. It feels... I've kind of tried to design Dance Macabre so that it feels and looks like kind of, you know, the OSR, whatever we want to consider that nowadays. But to be significantly more approachable.
Nice. So what challenges did you come across when you're making this game?
Oh my God. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is really just in the lore and in the setting. There is just so much that I don't know historically. And so I've found that in the last couple of years, I've had to spend a lot of time researching, partially just because, you know, we don't want to get stuff wrong. We don't want to misrepresent anybody. And yeah, I think it's been an interesting challenge to kind of square that circle of real politic in reality, like the actual, political reality of the time. With this kind of fantasy version of it that we've created. And just making sure that everything is accurate to a point. And also, you know, I'm very aware of my own position as an American and as somebody who has never lived in the Mediterranean. So trying to be very careful around just the details of history and culture at the time, while also still making it fun to engage with.
Yeah, it could be interesting, because the first season we did on the podcast was Call of Cthulhu, and it was set in, like, the 1920s America, and obviously,
yeah.
1920s America versus modern day, some things, let's see, aren't
very
quite...
Very different.
The actual core, like, rule books and such kept to 1920s wording,
mm-hmm.
and it's always a decision to go, okay, that's accurate to the time.
But right.
That's not what it is now. You got to make decisions about how much you want to be real.
I think we did quite well.
Yeah.
We did, although I think certain episodes would be viewed the asylum one. It might be a bit rough.
Hey, that wasn't my
I think our
yeah.
sure. Yeah, I think our views on mental health are quite different than they used to be 100 years ago. Thankfully.
Mm.
I mean, that's
especially
actually...
since it's Lovecraft.
That's a real love-hate relationship for me, and I think for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's always the how and do we separate the art from the artist question there.
With Lovecraft, you have two choices.
Tough.
You can make the game about not being what he is, like your characters are like somehow 23rd century self-aware, that is wrong, we think. Or you can just be, it's Lovecraft. You know what you're getting into. The person who's like raving in the corner should be on psych meds possibly, but they're probably just possessed. You know?
Sure.
More than likely.
Yeah. I mean, I think, now that we're kind of talking about this, it is interesting. Mental health is also a thing that has come up in Dance Macabre, because one of the mechanics that exists in it is that if you accrue too many Maleficia, too many mutations, you lose your humanity. So you essentially become a monster in the landscape. And yeah, it's an interesting question to be like, okay, well, do we call these people insane? Do we call, like, what's the terminology that we use? And I think my instinct is just to frame it in the kind of religious context at the time. So it's not that they're insane, but yeah, maybe people think that they're possessed or something like that, as a way of trying to, again, circle that square, just trying to like navigate that language. Because you're right, you do have to make those decisions. You know, I think that simulationism in the meanest possible way would not be fun. It would also just be incredibly exclusionary. And yeah.
Can you walk us through the character creation? Who would a person play? What would they play as? How does that change with all these mutations and whatnot over time?
Yeah, yeah. So the player characters are called pilgrims. And in the context of the game, being a pilgrim is very specific. So you are essentially somebody who is from the either peasant classes or kind of like the lower middle classes at the time. So, you know, you had peasants, you had merchants, kind of mercantile capitalism again was starting at the time, and scholars, which were almost always tied to religious institutions. And then kind of the fourth class that we have that player characters are not excluded from playing, but it's not it's not in the text. It's basically the nobility. So player characters come from either straight up the peasantry or from kind of like lower burgeoning middle class at the time. But you are somebody who has been convicted and found guilty of a crime. Whether or not your character is guilty of that truly, if they really did it, I kind of leave that up to the players, just as a way for them to kind of make their own backstory there. But the idea is that in this society where you have this kind of main city state and then outside of it is just abandoned wilderness that is covered in hordes of demoniacs, of people who have lost their humanity, you are, instead of, you know, just being put to death or put in prison or anything like that, you're given a choice. You can either be exiled out of Constantinople and, you know, tough shit. If you're exiled, you get a brand on your forehead that basically just tells other settlements or anybody that you run across who's not a demoniac in the wild that, you know, you're an outlaw. You are literally an outlaw. Or the other choice that you're given is that you can become a pilgrim and work for this organization called the Canticum Eternum, which is responsible for the collection and maintenance of these specific artifacts, which are called quintessent items. Items with quintessence have this kind of pseudo-magical ability to allow people just to die normally. And they're kind of like batteries. They run out as you use them. So the idea is that, you know, your player character is somebody who has chosen to become a pilgrim. I could also see, you know, maybe you eschew that and decide to just be outlaws. That could be cool too. But the idea is that you are being sent out into the wilderness basically as scouting parties, but just to find and collect as much quintessence as you can bring back. And then the idea is that you kind of have a little bit of a bargain with the Canticum, where if you, you know, serve for long enough, you can be a citizen again. You can be kind of like set free from your bondage. But that's always a narratively and kind of canonically, that's always a moving goalpost. You know, it's like, oh yeah, one more run, one more quest, whatever. But yeah, that's the idea, is that you are being sent out to collect these items. And then we're also building in some downtime rules. So the idea is that, you know, they're not going to send you out like literally every day. You will have time to interact with people in Constantinople, other factions that are there, and, you know, kind of up to the players to figure out what they want to do from there. Oh, and I should say the Canticum is exclusively run by the nobility. and this isn't something, this isn't something that's in Prima Mors, but it's something that I've been developing since that got published last year, which is that, you know, the quintessence is this resource that everybody wants because nobody wants to become a mutant. Nobody wants to, you know, lose themselves and just live forever mindlessly out in the wilderness. But in practice, again, only the nobility really have access to the stores of quintessence that the Canticum keeps.
So what was the best part of making this game and the worst part? The highs and the lows.
Oh man, the highs and the lows. That's a good question. I mean, the highs really are just being able to, well, let me think about that for a second. The highs are just watching people play, honestly, like at conventions or playtests so far, or just my friends who have been playing independent of me as well. Just being able to hear the narratives that they've kind of created out of it is so, so thrilling and so satisfying to me. Because I think, you know, a lot of people who do this kind of work probably feel the same way, but it's like, you know, it's your baby. It's kind of scary to put this out into the world. In particular, because it's a weird concept, and you know, I was always afraid that the historicity of it would be a flaw, not a feature. But people have been able to jump into it. People have had a lot of fun with it, and just being able to see that, like, oh, it works, and people are not, I guess, turned off or turning away from this kind of like vision that I've had is so exciting. I think the lows, honestly. it's just wrangling myself more than anything. I have pretty bad inattentive ADHD, so it's keeping to a schedule is very, very tough.
You're and, preaching to the choir there. It's a thing where all three of us here have it.
Yeah.
So you know. But yeah, I mean, luckily I have a lot of really great support from the Stillfleet Studio team, as well as my amazing partner, Jin De La Vega, who is on another Actual Play podcast, who I would love to shout out, Fun City. They do Shadowrun, and they've also run a Stillfleet campaign before. So they're good friends of the studio. But yeah, I have a lot of great support. I have a lot of people who are behind me on it, so that has made it a lot easier just to corral myself to get the work done. But you know, there's always like a new idea. There's always a new exciting thing, and it's about keeping that focus, which is... It's hard. It's hard to lock in, but got to do it.
So, what kind of experiences are you aiming to create with Danse Macabre? I mean, you've spoken about the setting, you've spoken about how the world looks. Are you trying to get some sort of like horror into players in that as well, or some thrillers?
Yeah, so I do describe the book as medieval horror. I'm a big body horror fan personally. I think that it's
nice.
To me, one of the most interesting kind of sub-genres of horror. You know, just dealing with personhood and liminality and kind of the in-between phases of changing and all that good stuff. So yeah, I wanted there to be body horror elements, and again, as like a lever for exploring those kind of like social changes, but what if those were made manifest in kind of disturbing ways? So yeah, I think horror is a big part of the experience. One of the things that I'm really trying to drive for is to make it less combat intensive, which is kind of an interesting problem for an OSR inspired game. But yeah, I want it to feel more like survival horror than it does that you're like, you know, going in and like kicking ass all the time. So there's certain mechanics in the book. I lean pretty heavily on this mechanic, which is just called hordes, the horde mechanic, which is where you're fighting massive bodies of individuals instead of kind of one at a time. And it's extremely, extremely deadly. And again, you know, the idea is that like, yeah, you can die and you can come back, but you lose a little bit of yourself each time. So you do want to avoid dying as much as possible, unless you really want a cool mutation. But the mutations are also random. You roll for it, so you don't really have any kind of control over that, which I also...
Matt, you don't want to know what I'd do in a system where dying gives me something I'm bad enough as is.
But yeah, I think trying to find, I guess, an intersection between, yeah, that body horror and kind of a historical appreciation. But then also, you know, I should just put it out there. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist. And so it's also very much a game about labor politics at the same time. Again, you are a peasant or, you know, a very, very low status merchant or scholar. You have been essentially exiled, and you're looking for quintessence, which who knows what it really is, but the secret is that it is labor. It is the labor power that goes into creating an object. So in the game, items that have quintessence are usually like pieces of art or architecture that have taken a lot of time and skill to put into it, or just anything that's been kind of created through human labor that just, you know, took a lot of that labor power to create. So, yeah, that's nowhere kind of explicitly said in the text, but that's also kind of a part of the experience for me is just metaphorically examining labor relations. And I think that the late 14th century is a really interesting time to do that because, again, things were changing super rapidly. You have the beginning of the Renaissance in Italy and other places. And, you know, the social structure completely was not upended, but it was starting to be upended. So
yeah, you have the collapse of all the big empires.
Exactly. Coming around. And then, you know, again, it's like, your position as a peasant or as a kind of lower middle class person, and you are essentially an indentured servant to the nobility. So not much has really changed in that way in the game. But trying to find a way to kind of explore that without it being completely front and center. Yeah, that's another thing that I've put into it that I hope people get out of.
All right. Are there any mutations you've made up in particular? Because we're playing through Blissercourts now. Is there any you've made up for your game that you think are just stand out, like really fun or really cool?
Yeah,
or really
yeah.
Horrific. That's always a good one too.
Let me take a look at this list I got here.
Nice.
Someone came prepared.
I did. Okay, yeah. So one of them that I really, really like is called Hemilacria. Which is it's a real biological thing. So like, you know, lizards that can shoot blood out of their eyes as a defense mechanism.
Yes.
That's Hemilacria. So that is a mutation that you can get. And the way that it presents itself in the game is that you are kind of constantly crying a stream of acidic, bloody tears. And then if you kind of like flex your face, you can shoot it out. And it has the potential to blind someone. And does a little bit of damage, but I just think that that's a fun one because it kind of takes this like very late Christian imagery of like, you know, crying pools of tears, or like if you've ever played the game Blasphemous, the Metroidvania video game, it's fantastic. It's essentially just Catholic horror.
But with big hats.
Yeah, big hats, big swords. But yeah, you know, you see a lot of that kind of iconography from kind of the Catholic world in particular. So kind of leaning into that where it's like, is this a religious thing? Is this a biological thing? Having that ambiguity is really interesting to me. But yeah, then there's also fun stuff like magnetokinesis is one of my favorite of the kinesis suite, as I've been calling it. So there's like pyrokinesis, hydrokinesis, things like that, controlling fire, controlling water. Magnetokinesis is essentially just your Magneto from X-Men. And there's some kind of complicated...
That's fun, too, because it's a time when there's a lot less metal around. You can't huck a skyscraper or something.
Yeah, exactly. You might be able to, like, pull somebody by, like, their cuirass or something, or, you know, something like that, or, like, pull a weapon out of somebody's hand or throw something using it. But, yeah, I think that's an interesting one, too. So trying to have a balance between... very visible kind of body horror mutations and then less visible Maleficia that instead kind of gives you these nearing like psychic powers. And those all also have kind of physical manifestations as well. So like magnetokinesis, your skin kind of gives off a dull gleam, like it's a dull metal. There's another one, electrokinesis, where it's like you are scarred by kind of like fractal lightning patterns all over your skin, things like that.
Is it Lichtenberg?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
I'm just Googling now. When was the first Prince Albert piercing? Because that magneto was very brutal in that one. First century AD.
Hey.
Hey.
Body horn.
Hey, if you if you're putting iron on your thingy, kind of taking your own risk there.
I'm picturing just when they get this power, they spawn in, revive from the vampire style with like a magnet in their hand.
You wake up and your hand is just a like a cartoon U-shaped magnet.
Yes.
I can get into that.
So how much kind of playtesting and whatnot have you done so far? Has it influenced how you've developed the game, or anything majorly come out from it?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, we've mostly been doing playtesting at cons, and then I have a home game that I've been running. And then we're actually going to, on the Stillfleet Discord, we're going to be running kind of bi-weekly West Marches styles playtests. So people can drop in and out, but you know, you go on like kind of a weekly quest in that case. I think, you know, one of the biggest things that has changed from playtesting is character creation, which actually I just realized I didn't walk us through earlier, but the way that it's written in Prima Mors is that there are six backgrounds that you can choose from or just roll randomly for. And each one of those has kind of a limited set of powers. You got like two powers from each one of those. And then that's kind of, you know, your character is a pilgrim, but they were once X, right? Farmer, soldier, city guard, things like that. So one of the things that's changed for that is that, again, trying to focus more on kind of the class politics at the time, you have three choices. Again, you can roll randomly, but you're also given a choice. So you can either have a background as a peasant, as a merchant, or as a scholar. And then each one of those backgrounds has a pool of 20 powers that you can choose from when you're starting out the game. And some of them overlap, but for the most part, you know, scholars tend to focus on insight, which is your kind of mental acuity and perception, as well as fervor. Because again, most, if not all scholars at the time were tied to religious institutions. So there's a bit of a mix there. Peasants tend to focus only on the kind of bodily traits, so your vitality and your finesse, which is essentially strength and dexterity. And then the merchant class is just kind of a middle ground between the two. So they focus on fervor, which is used for activating a lot of your maleficia, but it's also used for social interaction. And then they also focus on finesse. So some light crafting mechanics, things like that. So, you know, if you choose a merchant class, you could be an artist, you could be literally a peddler, you can be kind of anything like that in between. But I'm kind of leaving it up to people to define their own like actual background by choosing the specific powers that they have, but leaving it kind of broad and class based, not in a role playing game sense of class, but like in a real world sense of class.
Nice.
Yeah, but yeah. Go ahead.
So, the game as it is set in the remnants of the Byzantine Empire. Once the game's been released, it's all good to go. Would you plan any expansions? Try taking over Rome a little bit, or go the other direction and head more into the sort of Middle East and Asia?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that we're really excited about, actually. And for the Kickstarter box set that we're putting together, we are planning on having an extra book that comes with the main rulebook. which I think it's basically just going to be a book of quest hooks, right? And the idea is to explore the setting in different places using that book. So I'm going to be writing a section, our friend Wyth is going to be writing a section, and then we're trying to get other TTRPG creators who, you know, like, either have a very specific interest or connection to different areas of the world to kind of write about what that would look like at that place's history or historical moment. So yeah, I mean, the main book, honestly, it's Constantinople because I find it interesting. Also, the original, in Prima Mors, we have like Constantinople, Granada, Avignon as possible settings, but frankly, it was too much for me to research and write like three very different cultures, three very different places. So, yeah, we settled on Constantinople, but the idea is to continue to support it, especially if it does well, and to expand the setting outward, explore different geographical areas. But yeah, I mean, I would love to do one in the UK or, you know, proto UK at the time.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
How many levels of Kickstarter are you looking at potentially creating them? What's your kind of tier listing that you're thinking of doing?
That's a good question, actually. I think we're still figuring that out at the moment. I think...
Any particular collectibles or goodies in particular?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, so the box set is slated to come with the main rulebook, set, as well as the kind of secondary quest book. In that, there will also be a deck of 78 tarot-sized cards, which will have quintessent items on them. And I'm very excited for that little project because it's an opportunity to bring in kind of different cultural touchstones. You know, we're taking some inspiration from our friends over at the Maniculum. They published a book last year, which is all mythological items for D&D. So there's going to be some stuff from myth that's mixed in there, as well as like real world artifacts, things like that. But just giving people kind of concrete examples of what these artifacts could be or look like. So the front of the card will have an illustration. Back of the card will basically have like a stat block, as well as like an explainer. Maybe like a one paragraph explainer, something like that. So that enables people who are either prepping for a game to draw from that to be like, all right, this is the item that we're looking for, or just have it be kind of randomly generated whenever you finish your quest. So that's very fun. I'm very excited about that. I'm also making a cloth map, which I'm super stoked about. We actually just were talking about this yesterday. I don't know. Are y'all familiar with the game Harn? H-A-R-N? Harn?
No, but I'm familiar with the game Doomsong, and they made a cloth map.
Well, Harn
very
is...
very nice quality.
Yeah. Harn is, like, you know, 80s, kind of 90s, really interesting fantasy RPG, but they have this incredible map that shows the continent of Harn. And then around it is this kind of marginalia, honestly, that just gives you like setting information.
Is it the one with the coats of arms and stuff?
Yep. That's the one. So yeah, we're going to be creating a Harn style map that will center mostly around Constantinople, but also kind of expand out all the way to Granada and then into the east as well. So you'll get a lot of information about like potential setting, other city-states that exist at the time, as well as just game info, as well as you know, kind of specific settings stuff about Constantinople. Gotta love a roommate. Boy,
I think if there's background noise, I'll finish this one off with it. So. One of the last kind of questions we ask, along with where people can find you, is what advice would you give to aspiring TTRPG creators?
I think that the best advice is, maybe this is twofold. The first part is just to write as much as possible. You can always edit stuff out. I think that there's a lot of value in just kind of vomiting your ideas out onto a page and seeing what sticks. But I think writing consistently and writing as much as you can imagine, especially in the first stages of creating a game, when you're really trying to work out what the world is and trying to work out how, you know, mechanics connect to diegesis and all of that good stuff. I think that it's worth taking the time to really just write until you're kind of just out of ideas, and then refining it from there. The second part of that is just engage with community. That's a big part. That was, I think, when I first started writing, that was maybe one of the toughest things, because I hadn't really been a part of the, you know, like Twitter TTRPG community or the Forge or any of that kind of stuff that's been around. And so just getting my game out in front of people was tough, but over time and over several different, you know, smaller games that I've worked on, I think that's the most valuable thing, right? It's a social game. It needs to have feedback. It needs to have as many eyes on it as possible. And yeah, just making sure that you're putting it out there, even if it's at an unfinished stage, it's worth it, because you will get feedback. And sometimes even silence is feedback. So just take the step, put it on itch, or, you know, put it on a Discord server. Just have your friends look at it, let them tell you what they like about it, and then, you know, make your changes from there.
And lastly,
what's up?
You're free now, are you?
I'm free. Sort of.
Go on, then shut us down then, Jay.
Alright then. Expected to be able to talk at all. That is the last question, actually, Matt. I don't
say, where can people find you?
Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me personally. I'm on Instagram under @timespace.place. I mostly put my illustration and tattoo work on there, but there's also, you know, if you want to just get connected, I'm on there. I am also, I'm so bad at social media, man. Like, I don't know. Instagram's probably the best place for me personally, but you can also find information about Dance Macabre at the Stillfleet website, so www.stillfleet.com. And then, we've got an itch page, so if you'd like to download Dance Macabre Prima Mors, you can do it. It's pay what you want. You know, if you want to give us a couple bucks, that's cool. If not, don't worry about it. I would rather just have you play in the game. So yeah, itch.
Looking at your tattoo stuff now, dude. It's incredible.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, same.
But yeah, itch.
You're looking to get another one, right?
Hey, come to New York. It'll only be cold for another 3 months.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you. We're looking forward to having our little play test on Saturday the 25th.
Yeah.
So this will probably come out, if I can get this done for the 24th, then the game should come out on the 31st. Thank you very much, everyone. Links will be in description to find anything that Chris has mentioned. Thank you all for now, and buddy, bye.
Thanks for having me.